called Welcome to Discover Your Talent to Do What You Love, number 216. I'm creator and host Don Hutchison. Every day, I interview someone from around the world who has discovered her talents to do work she loves to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Phyllis Gillis. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Quick question. Are you using your talents doing work that you love?
I am. It took a long time to discover the right mix of my skills and my talents and what I love. But at this point, I'm absolutely living in an environment that allows me to utilize those skills. And I'm working every day doing a job that I absolutely love.
All righty. We want to hear the whole story. A few words about Phyllis's career. Phyllis Gillis is the founder and CEO of Food Paths Incorporated, serial storytelling connecting farmers with families at the crossroads of food. An award-winning writer and photojournalist, Phyllis brings behind-the-scenes authenticity to the stories of people who grow our food and what we eat. Her diverse and successful career spans the worlds of journalism, business, and culinary arts. Formerly a contributing editor of Parents Magazine and the author of three books, recent work appears in Wine Business Monthly. Phyllis, that's a summary of your career. Tell us what you're up to now that has you engaged and excited.
Well, my focus right now is just continuing to produce Food Paths on a bi-monthly basis. We're based in California, and until now, we have covered California farmers. We plan to branch out over the next year into different parts of the country. We'll be visiting New Mexico in a few months, and then your part of the world will be visiting Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, and hopefully your home turf as well.
Excellent, excellent. Well, what was the genesis of Food Paths? How did it all get started?
I have a long career. I'm one of these people that's a bit of a nomad, and so I've bounced around a bit. But the most recent bounce landed me in Napa. I had been working as the director of communications for a large law firm in San Francisco, and about 30% of their practice area was the wine industry. So I spent a lot of time working with winemakers and the owners of a variety of high-end wineries here in the Napa Valley. When it was time to move on to something else, I was recruited by a Napa Valley recruiter. I was the obvious person because I knew so many wineries up here. I knew the owners. And also, I had a lot of media experience, and I'm a trained chef, so I also had culinary experience. I was recruited to build a brand for an appellation. An appellation is a distinct region where the grapes that are grown have very, very distinct characteristics. So it was a question of just putting together the skills and the talents I had over a long period of time to wind up in the Napa Valley running a wine appellation and then moving to the next stage of writing about agriculture in a broader sense.
Okay. So you were recruited to build the brand for an appellation. And how long did you do that?
I did that for 5 years.
Okay.
I would have continued, except the recession hit a few years ago. People were not buying high-end wines anymore. And so I was laid off.
Recessions are often a good time to do something different. You thought it was a good time to come up with the idea of Food Paths?
You know, I think when you go through parts of your life where you have ups and downs and it's time to move on or a recession, you take a step backward and you think about, okay, how am I going to spend the next part of my life? Because I live in Napa and I worked in the wine industry and I'm also a trained professional chef.
Mm-hmm.
It started to come together. I didn't want to continue working in the wine industry. It wasn't a good time to be there.
Okay.
But being based in California, I thought, and because I had a base in agriculture, what happened over the period of time that I was working in the wine industry, I realized that I thought I had been hired to work in the wine industry,
mm-hmm.
but actually I was hired to work in agriculture. We forget that a bottle of wine is made of grapes, not concentrated grape juice.
Right.
And they come from the ground. So the years that I was here, I really learned about agriculture from the ground up. So from there, it was just an easy step forward to start looking out to other crops in California. California is one of our biggest agricultural producers. Mm-hmm. And I knew people throughout the states. I just started calling farmers that I knew, family farmers, and they were, much to my shock and awe and surprise, they'd say, sure, come on down to Bakersfield. We'll be glad to talk to you. Mm-hmm. So in the first few months, I interviewed a potato farmer, a bean farmer, and then I was referred to one of the largest mushroom growers internationally. Oh. And that's how I got started. And I started to write about agriculture from their perspective, telling their stories. And then they also gave us a family recipe that we used initially so that it brought it closer home to the reader.
Beautiful, beautiful. And this is available online as a free service. So you sponsor, you have sponsors. How does it work?
At this point, I do some other consulting work on the side. It's self-funded. We have developed a series of product lines and projects in the pipeline. I'm not ready to talk about those, but okay. I think we're very, very close to monetizing it. At this point, we describe it as Food Paths is serial storytelling at the crossroads of food. Mm-hmm. We tell the stories, as you said, about family farmers and how they grow and bring their crops to the family table. But we're all online, we're digital, and at this point, it's totally free to the reader.
Okay. Yeah, we could have long discussions about the drought and about GMOs and other things that are impacting food farmers everywhere across the world, couldn't we?
Yes, we could. And the one thing that I've learned is that if you work in agriculture, the CEO is Mother Nature.
Yes.
You have to understand that there's a great deal of uncertainty in this particular industry. And when you wake up in the morning, you just never know. Are you going to have frost earlier than expected on your crops? Are the buds out and are they going to be frozen? If they're frozen, you lose a whole crop.
Wow.
And drought is hitting the region very, very severely right now.
Yes.
And so the recent rains we've had are building up in the reservoirs out here, and everybody's out, you know, thrilled and delighted.
Right. Yeah, I understand the almond. Isn't California the biggest producer of almonds in the country?
Yes. Yes. I actually interviewed an almond grower a few years ago.
Well, as we've discussed, everyone's life journey is composed of a series of turning points or passages, as they're called. At these times, we're faced with obstacles and opportunities and choices that determine the next 4 or 5 years of our lives. This is the way that we've evolved since the dawn of man, I think. Tell us about your more memorable turning points that got you to be who you are today.
When you think about how you develop a career or what makes up with you, I think you have to go back to your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I have only 2 skills. I've come to understand that there are 2 things that I can do and I can do well. And one of them is that I can write. And the other thing is that I can cook. Mm-hmm. I learned how to cook from my grandmother, hanging around in her kitchen. My first article was published when I was 8 years old. Not saying that I did this, but I wrote a story about my brother. I grew up in Cleveland. The Cleveland Press had a children's section, and my mother sent it to him. And they, much to my shock and awe, they published it. So that was my very, very first article.
Wow.
And I had my first short article in 17 magazine when I was 15. And then over the years, I always wrote for all the school papers and went to graduate school at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern.
Oh, my word. Where did you do your undergraduate?
At Michigan State.
Oh, that's another fine school.
Yes.
Well, what was it like growing up? Were they writers and readers and cooks?
I came from a very, very middle-class family in Cleveland, Ohio. My dad was a salesman.
Okay.
And he was a charmer. You know, he could sell anything. And he sold appliances and televisions during the time that everybody was buying new televisions. So we lived a comfortable life. My mom was a housewife. A smart woman who today could be running a small company. Mm-hmm. But during that era, she didn't do that. She took care of the kids. But I always had this creative outlook at life. The kids in the neighborhood would get together and we'd all put on shows and puppet shows. And I was the writer.
Oh.
So I didn't get to do anything else. I was the only one that could actually string words together. So I was the writer from that point.
Interesting. What led you in education in Michigan State? Did you major in English or what did you do?
They have a very good journalism school.
Okay.
And I had some friends that went there. I didn't want to go to Ohio State because all of my friends were living there. And I wound up at Michigan State. They had a great journalism school, and I wound up working for the school paper for most of the time that I was there. And they actually had paid positions for their top staff.
Oh, I'll be darned. That's unusual.
Yeah. I mean, for those years, it was really quite amazing. I wound up working full time, which meant 4 to 6 hours a day for the paper. And for that, I was paid $60 a week. Mm-hmm. For most of the time that I was school. So it actually helped not only pay for my college education, but also allowed me to get an awful lot of experience.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Okay, so what happened next?
So then I went to Northwestern. As part of our graduate training, each of us had to work a beat in the city of Chicago. During the time that I was there, Governor Ronald Reagan, before he became president, was on the political tour, speaking on behalf of his party. And he was the governor of California at the time, so mm-hmm. he had a position. I was in the State of Illinois building, and I hung out with a couple of very burly, big Chicago reporters. I was their mascot. I had uncovered a story and shared it with them, and I think this was payback for sharing that with them. But they took me to hear Governor Reagan speak. And as we walked into the auditorium, security stopped us at the door, and they said, okay, who are you, to me? And the two guys said, well, she's with us. She's a young reporter, and she's just starting out. And they said to the two reporters, well, you can go in, but she can't get in. She's not press. She doesn't have a press card. We must have been making an awful lot of noise, because Mrs. Reagan came over and said, what's going on here? And the two guys explained that I was a Medill student, and I was a graduate student in journalism, and they had invited me to come in and hear the governor speak. And she looked me up and down. Then she started questioning me, and she said, you're a graduate student? I said, yes. And she said, and she turned around, and she said to the security guys, she said, you guys let her in. You never know where she's going to land. And I have never forgotten that. Because over the course of my career, the adage, you never burn a bridge,
yes,
or you never know where you're going to wind up, really plays very, very well. This was decades ago, and I still remember her taking charge of the situation. So you never know where she's going to land. Let her in.
Wow, that's perfect.
So that was a big turning point for me.
Yes. What happened next in the storyline?
So I went off. I got married. I wound up living on the East Coast. Like many people, wound up in the middle of a divorce, and I couldn't get a job because I had a child, and we lived in a rural community, and it was a difficult period of time. I think a lot of people go through it. You have young children, you've been out of the workforce for a while. How do you start to get back into it or earn a living while you're going through a crisis? Mm-hmm. So I could cook, and one of the chef owners of one of the local restaurants knew that, and he called me one day, and he said, listen, I just had a chef walk out. Can you work for me a couple nights a week running the kitchen? At that time, I knew a young nursing student, and she was looking for a place to live, so I asked her to come and live with me. I had a big house at the time, and she took care of my child at night, which enabled me to work in the kitchen.
Oh,
so
good.
I became the on-site night chef, and I did that for 2 years and learned how to run a kitchen.
Oh, excellent. Yes.
So the next part was after everything was taken care of, out of that came one of my books. I wrote a book about a young woman, a young mother, working the night shift in a kitchen with the antics of my staff while spending her days in court fighting for custody of my child. That made the New York Times best books of the year.
Oh, my gosh.
That really, I think, began to turn me around to realize that I had these two skills.
Mm-hmm. What was the title of the book?
The name of the book is Days Like This.
Oh, good title.
And I think you can still get it either on Amazon or a Libris. I know that libraries have them.
Okay. We'll list it in our show notes. So Days Like This, and so there you are. You've written the book. You've proven that you can be a chef. Okay, but those are powerful skills.
Well, then I decided it was about time that I better start making some money.
Okay.
So after the 2 years in the kitchen, the divorce was over, I sold the house, and I lived in a little town called New Hope, Pennsylvania, which is close to Trenton and very close to Princeton, New Jersey. And I had a lot of friends who lived in Princeton at the time. And so I knew somebody in the real estate business, and she found me a small house, which I could afford. I moved to Princeton. And by doing that, I was able to put my child in a good public school system. We stayed there for years, and he graduated from Princeton High and then went on to Tulane in New Orleans, had a great education.
It's a fine school.
It's a wonderful school.
Yeah.
He won a scholar. He was a founder scholar when he was there. So that was great. Previous to that time, lawyers hadn't been allowed to advertise. And I knew that there were a lot of others in the area doing public relations and hospitality, media relations, politics. And I thought, well, you know, lawyers make a good living. This is a new industry breaking out. I think I'll start a public relations firm and I'll focus on lawyers.
Whoa.
And that's exactly what happened, because a lot of them wanted to promote themselves, but they didn't want to advertise. They wanted the discreet form of behind the scenes public relations.
Yes.
I ghost wrote a lot of the articles for them and their speeches. The agency was called Entrepreneurial Communications.
Oh, nice.
I was there for 10 years, and then I sold it to a New York public relations firm. My son went off to college. I'd had enough of the Northeast winters, and one of my clients referred me to a very large law firm in San Francisco. I was the first media consultant hired to be the director of communications for a large, prestigious firm in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And then I subsequently worked for two firms over a period of 10 years in the Northern California area.
I've been close to the advertising and PR field for all my career. That must have been a fascinating transition, helping lawyers understand how they can communicate their worth in a way that's not promotional.
Well, you know, it depends who you work with. I was very, very fortunate. The first firm that I worked for had a wonderful chairman, and I worked for him directly. He knew what he didn't know. Mm. And I think that's a blessing.
Yes, it is.
To have that self-awareness. And when I was hired, he said, I'm a really good litigator, but I don't know anything about media. So I have one request of you. And that is, no matter what the issue, when you come to talk to me, you have to keep in mind that I demand two words out of anyone that works for me. And those two words are no surprises.
Okay.
Keep it open. I'll do whatever you want. I will follow your directions, but good, bad, or indifferent, no surprises. And then we'll work it out. And that was, I think, very wise advice, because, you know, when you're working for a law firm, there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes.
Oh, big time.
You know, to win a case.
Big time.
That's part of the business.
Yes.
So I was there for a few years, and then I was recruited by another firm. The second firm had a very large wine practice. So that's how I learned the wine industry from a business standpoint.
Okay, perfect. This is a good touch point to move into the theme of the show, which is most people in their lives, studies around the world every year, are not in their sweet spot, as I call it, doing work that they love or using their skills and talents. And they may be making a good living, maybe making a fine living, but there's still parts of them that want more. What is that about? Why do you think people get stuck and can't get unstuck?
Well, how do people get unstuck?
How do they get stuck? I mean, you've just given us this whole story from the time you were a little girl. You learned that you could write and cook. Okay, that's an amazing blessing. You saw your talents early on. You felt them. You trusted your instincts. What happens to everybody else?
I think there are a couple of things, Don. I think people get stuck because of money and family. And I think those are two really huge motivators. Oftentimes, you wind up in a career you maybe hate, but because you're being paid a salary, you have benefits, you have kids going off to college, you've got the mortgage, you have a bigger sense of commitment to the family or to not making change, or there's a fear of change,
mm-hmm.
that you resist moving on. And mm-hmm. it's very, very, very difficult to do that when you are in that position. For me, the turning point, the real key turning point for me was I was working for the second law firm. My mother was dying of Alzheimer's, and while she still recognized my voice, she wasn't lucid at all. And so I called her one day, and she said to me, "Phyllis, I can't talk to you. I'm going to a wedding, and I have to make a decision about what color shoes I'm wearing." And I thought, wow, she's thinking about going to a party, and I'm going to my job at the law firm.
Right.
I walked to work. I got into the elevator. I went up to my office on the 31st floor, and I couldn't get off. I absolutely couldn't get off. I pushed the button back to the ground floor, took it back, got off the elevator, went home, called in sick, and 3 days later, I resigned and enrolled in culinary school.
Wow. Wow. It all just came full form into your mind with that exchange with your mom. Your whole life just flashed before you.
Well, that's exactly it. And I was at a point in my life where I was bored. I had great jobs and I worked with great people, but I was bored. And I was also burned out. You know, when you work in the corporate world, you work 24/7 and you're paid well and you have benefits and vacations and whatever, but it does take a toll. And I had reached that point where I had to get out. I just had to get out. So I went to culinary school, not because I wanted to be a chef, but I needed some time to tread water.
Yes.
And figure out what the next move was going to be.
What would you say to people that are out there listening who, whether they're, I always say this, 18 or 80, whether they're heading off into their first career or whether they're in mid-career, late career, what would you say to them about how to pay attention to their options and how to plan?
Well, I'm one of these women that has never really planned my career. Things happen. You know, I think there are a few golden rules. And okay. One of them is this, never burn a bridge.
Right.
Because people who you come across over the course of your life, whether it's in your family or your personal life or your professional life, at some point things are going to turn around. And you never know where a lead is going to take you. Second thing, I think a lot of people put their psychic energy in one job. They have one skill that they can do, and they spend their whole career doing that. And I think in today's world, it's probably not a bad idea to have a toolbox of a couple of skills.
Bingo.
People that concentrate on one career, they may be a very good lawyer or a very good doctor, and they're focused on what they're doing and making a lot of money, but they come out of the other end, and that's it. You know, there are so many opportunities to volunteer, to take classes, to take something that you love and move it into a way of making a living on it. From my standpoint, money has never been the top criteria for me in my life. Mm-hmm. Never. Mm-hmm. I've always made a very good living, but it's never been my primary motivator.
Right.
And I think that that's something that certainly is one of the things that have guided me.
Well, just stay open to the possibilities. Be curious. Be, you know, just always explore yourself.
I think people have difficulty doing that when they're on the treadmill. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very good advice because a lot of people don't look at themselves from an internal standpoint. It would be great if it were sort of built into our psyche from the time that we're younger. And certainly the younger generation today are open to anything.
Yes.
I've hired a number of interns and they just think differently.
Right. Just very briefly, what have been the greatest benefits to you? You said you didn't have a plan, but you always acted and you've been very strategic when opportunities arose. So you are a strategic planner, actually. What have been the greatest benefits to you, for lack of a better phrase, following your instincts and honing your talents as you've gone along?
I always had a backup plan.
Okay.
I may have been going for the higher end job, but things happen. We have recessions. Companies go out of business. You know, newspapers fold. political parties change. And if you're working in Washington, all of a sudden you're on the other side of the aisle. So you're left out there. So I think having a backup plan is always a good thing to keep in your back pocket. I mean, I always knew that I could get a job in the kitchen. I always knew I could get a job for a caterer as an on-site chef. And I have done that over time when I've been out of the traditional work field. And I think it doesn't really matter what you do. You learn from each of those experiences.
Yes. What do you see going forward over the next handful of years with, you know, certainly with Food Pass and other work that you're doing? What's your vision?
Well, Food Pass was designed to be both educational and entertaining. I think that I've learned that people learn better when it's a combination of education and entertainment.
Yes.
Look at Sesame Street.
Yes.
Perfect business model and creative outlet.
Right.
And so I'm going to continue writing and refining Food Pass to combine those elements. We started about 3 months ago, I started a different section. It's called The Cosmic Gremlins of Phyllis Gillis. And it's sort of a humorous look at some of the experiences that I've had that relate to whoever we're featuring that particular month. And so it puts more of a personal spin on the story, as well as giving you the story of the farmer.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. We're working on a number of products and projects. I'm not willing to disclose them too much.
Sure.
But one of the things that I did discover about 2 years ago was that in addition to writing, I could also become a photographer.
Ah.
I had used a commercial photographer in the early years, and he didn't show up one morning. I was on the way to interview a blueberry grower, and he called me from Los Angeles and said, "Hey, you know, I got a 3-day gig, so they're paying me $15,000, and you're not coming close to that, so I'm going to Los Angeles." I was literally at the entrance to the ranch where I was driving in. And I said, "Well, we're on a 48-hour shoot because this is where the bees come out to pollinate the blueberries." And
right.
I was doing the story on the connection between bees and pollination.
Which is vital, by the way, as you know.
It's vital, absolutely vital. And he said, "Well, didn't you buy a new camera?" And I said, "Yeah, I did buy a camera." And he said, "Well, do you have it with you?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Well, use it. I'm sure you can figure it out." That's how I became a photographer.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
So I'm doing all the photography, and I've sold a number of my photos. You know, hey, I really can do this.
Yeah,
the technology is so different today, and we're all digital.
Yes.
You don't need a huge double, triple-length sports camera. You know, I'm not a sports photographer.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question. What are you proudest of?
I'm proudest of being able to be independent at this point in my life. I mean, I've had, you know, a marriage. I've had relationships. I've raised a child alone. I'm doing something that I love. I have finally found a niche where it combines my writing skills, the photography skills that I have learned. And I understand the flow of what goes in the ground to what lands on the family table. I think I have the ability to translate some very complex concepts that I'm not being covered by the food media.
The family farmer used to be the backbone of our whole society.
Absolutely.
Now we have more people in prison than we have farmers.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. It's amazing.
The story of how food is being moved from the fields to the family table is one that needs to be told.
No, it has to.
I've earned the credibility because I understand it and because I don't work with a crew. It's me.
Right.
And that way you're able to build a personal relationship with the family and the farmer. And the other thing is farmers are up at 4:30 in the morning. The thing that has surprised most of them is that I'm up at 4:30 in the morning with them.
Wow.
If they're giving me the time and the interview, I'm going to be with them working their hours, not New York hours.
Yes. Well, good for
so
you.
So I've earned the credibility, I think, and developed an authenticity in turn on the other end for our readers.
Exactly. Well, Phyllis Gillis, what a great pleasure being with you today. We appreciate you sharing the highlights of your amazing journey. And I know that listeners around the world have learned lessons that will help them on theirs. So how did those listeners connect with you? What are some connecting points?
Well, they can sign into our website. We're free. And there's a sign in place at the top right to sign up free, or send an email to info@foodpaths.com. And we'll just put you on the list. You can also come in. We have an app and you can sign up with us. That's free at this point through any of the major Apple Store, Google, or Microsoft. We're on all three platforms.
Excellent. Excellent. Listeners know that you can go to discoveryourtalentpodcast.com and go to the podcast section where the highlights, the show notes of this fine interview are, and the links are there for your easy access. I want to thank you, listeners across the world, for joining us today, as every day. You can also subscribe for free on iTunes and Stitcher to our podcast. If you like our content, we'd love for you to join our tribe. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them. We can't ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive, we thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.